This week on Writers, Inc.
And that's why you go. You want to be on the ground where you can see things and learn things that are not in books, that are not written down anywhere. And that's another example of just being in the right place at the right time.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, I'm Christine Daigle.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So it has been a bad week if you're a social media company.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Is it that bad? Because, I mean, $6 million, that was what they determined. And that's not even a rounding error.
That's for one person. That's
for one person, but that's only one ruling. There was another one in Nevada for, I think, $345 million against Facebook.
Yeah, I think I did hear that. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think the two are going to actually play together if you kind of, because, like, you know, right now social media can't really be held responsible for the language or, you know, the text, like basically whatever their users put up there. I forget what the rule is, but there's an actual, like, a rule out there that prohibits that. So yeah. This is kind of stepping on that. But the ruling out of Nevada is interesting because they basically, you know, Facebook was accused of manipulating the algorithm to specifically target young kids and teenagers and basically make the platform addictive. So they might be able to use that as the catalyst for this latest ruling, because it's all going to go to the Supreme Court at some point.
Oh, yeah.
And it, you know, makes, you know, there's a good chance social media may not be around, you know, in like another 5 years if this actually plays out against them, because, you know, there's going to be a million lawsuits lining up right behind this one. You know, Facebook made me do this. Facebook did that. Facebook did, you know, I'm on medication because of this or what. You know, there's so many angles. Everybody's going to try.
Look, if you're going to commit crimes, this is the time to do it. You can blame everything on Facebook.
And it is Facebook's fault, right?
Yeah, it is.
Well, I mean, I think we've all known that they create addictive spaces. I mean, that's kind of, they want to keep people on the site. That's kind of part of the business model. So
yeah. So but is that illegal?
Yeah, you know, that's like the question.
See, but it wasn't illegal while they were doing it. So you can't retroactively make something illegal. So all they can do is change behavior going forward. I actually think this is going to lose on appeal. Once a higher court starts looking closely at this, you can't possibly, I mean, unless they have specific records saying, hey, we need to make this as addictive as possible and really wreck some kids' brains. It's going to be real tough for a higher court to say, yeah, I see it. I'm just going to nail them on that. Strictly Kevin's opinion.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if you combed through Zuckerberg's email account if you were to find something very similar to that.
Who knows? Another reason to make sure you have a mailing list and maybe more support for the direct sales. I don't know.
I mean, as a, well, your kid's growing up, so like, did you have to deal with social media? I'm guessing you did, right? Like,
no,
the whole time, or like he wasn't on there, he didn't care.
Oh, my kid no, he doesn't like social media. He stays off of it. He uses Discord to talk to certain people, but he was never a social media kid, so he was never on like Facebook or Instagram or TikTok. He has no interest in any of that. So I guess I'm lucky in that way. I have to try and keep him off the video games, but that's about it.
See, so my daughter is 8, and the school that she's in goes up to 5th grade. And a couple of the older girls in her school, you know, they use social media, or they know about social media. They're talking about social media. So it's trickling down. And it's trickling down in a way where, like, you know, it's just something very cool. And if you're cool, you need to be on it kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, so we've been able to keep her clear of it, you know, so far. But the rumblings are there.
Well, definitely in my job, I've had many instances where we've had to deal with cyberbullying over social media. And it's just, it's difficult. And even when the kids are getting bullied, they don't want to be off of it because that's their social connection. So
No, I mean, honestly, they probably double down because now they want to see what everybody else is saying, right? So they're
yeah,
monitoring more closely than they would have before. But
exactly.
that's kind of where this is going. If these rulings are upheld and Facebook and these other platforms could actually be held liable, they're going to have to rethink their entire business model because this kind of thing is happening everywhere.
Yeah.
And a couple of I mean, TikTok and a few of the other ones, they settled in advance, so they actually pulled themselves out of this thing before it actually got to a verdict.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I would say that TikTok is probably much more of a threat than Facebook
Oh,
was.
it's
So,
just the technology's moving so fast too, and it's so hard to keep
yeah.
up with. You know, for my day job, I do a bit of brain computer interface stuff with the external headsets. I don't implant anything. I attended a webinar this week, and it touched on brain to brain interface, which I guess has been done and can be done using the internet. So, I mean, that just blew my mind. I didn't even know that that was a
I mean,
thing.
but isn't that what we do as writers? Brain to brain
I was like,
interface.
I don't
That's what
even
we
want to
do.
get into the ethics of that, but I was just, I didn't even know that was possible to this week. So, yeah, lots of technology coming out.
I don't want anybody else in my head.
Yeah, I guess this guy in
Nobody
Britain,
else wants to be in my head.
yeah, in Britain
That's
implanted the other chip in his wife's head. So I was like, I don't know that that's a good idea. That would probably end my marriage if we were having brain to brain interface.
Do you want
I
Borg? Because this is how you get Borg.
don't
What were they actually able to do? Were they actually able to share some kind of thoughts or,
You
images
know, I
or?
have to look the study up because I just he was just talking about it, and I'm not sure how, like, communication, like, are they telepathic? I don't know, but I'm gonna look into it. But just that you can even do that, to me, it is wild. Yeah.
My brain's already thinking of like the military, implications of this. Like, imagine if all the soldiers had a hive mind.
Right?
Like,
Yeah.
where we're actually using real soldiers. I mean, it's all drones at this point. So,
Yeah.
who
Yeah.
knows? It'll be drones then too, just human breathing
It's
drones.
JD's next thriller.
Keep an eye on social media. That's where
So,
they're going to be.
Yeah. And your brain.
we have a reader question.
Oh, we do have a reader
We
question.
do.
We want to get to it. So. Brendan Kelso asks, hey JD, quick question for you. I've heard you mention a few times that you start in KU and after 3 months go wide. What's the advantage of starting in KU like that? Why not go wide straight out of the gate?
Yeah, so he's actually got it backwards. So
Yeah,
I
I
go
was going to
wide
say.
for the first 3 months, and then I pull it back and drop it exclusively into KU. I can't think of any reason where you would want to start in KU other than it tends to help with the algorithm. You're going to see your ranking a lot higher if you're in KU right out of the gate on publication date than going wide and then coming back to it. But
Yeah.
that's the only benefit that I can think of. I go wide to everybody. I drop it literally in draft to digital. Go out to every platform that they've got. Just set a reminder for 90 days out to take it out of there, and then just go exclusive to KU.
Yeah. Back in the day, I would do it this way. I'd go to KU with the books, and then after the 90-day lead, I would go wide. And I stopped doing that several years ago now, but I don't think there is really an advantage anymore. The idea at the time was, get that sweet, sweet KU money, and then have the best of both worlds by doing a second launch and going wide. But it lost its effectiveness somewhere along the way, so I stopped doing it. Now I don't do
Yes.
KU at all.
So I'm approaching it from a slightly different angle. I've got so many traditionally published books, and those all come out wide regardless. So my fans are used to that. So I've got a readership that's looking for that ebook from day one over on, their Nook or whatever platform that they use. So I give them that 90-day window in order to do that, download it, buy it. So I get a decent sales spike at the very beginning because, at this point my fans know they've only got 90 days if they want to grab it on those different platforms, and then it's going to go away. So I see that bounce, and then it, goes into KU, and then I start seeing the KU readership money. Which comes in later, and then I keep it in there, so it's a constant thing. So,
Yeah.
but it's like everything else. I think you just got to examine your own business model and figure out what's going to work best for you.
So the only model left to try is launch wide, go to KU, 90 days later, pull it back out of KU. That's the only model we haven't tried yet.
What happens if that does happen? Like, if you're a reader and you download a book from KU onto your device and it gets pulled from KU. It stays on your device, right? They just don't
Right.
allow anybody new to get
Right,
it.
it stays in your device, and you still get the page reads if they pick it up and start reading it. I still get page reads. I haven't been at KU for like 7 years now, and I still get Patriots because people got the book back when and only just now got to it. So
I do that all the
weird.
time. I see a book on sale or whatever, and I
Yeah.
download it. I probably have a
Yeah.
thousand books on my Kindle that I haven't opened.
Same.
Everybody does.
Cool. All right. What is in the news?
Well, in the news, cell phones on silent. The literary event is about to begin. Some publishers are creating in-person analog books, book events, and print experiences because readers are feeling tired of screens and want real-world connection. These efforts include live writing nights, literary salons, and even printed newspapers to build deeper community around books. The goal is to attract younger and less frequent readers by making reading feel social, tactile, and meaningful again.
I love this. And if we could somehow
Yeah.
rope in, like actual author talks, you're not allowed to bring your cell phone with you. That would be fantastic. Because like nothing freaks me out more than giving a talk and then looking out over the audience and seeing people holding up their cell phones, like recording the whole thing. Like for whatever, it just puts me on edge just knowing they're out there doing it. And like it happens everywhere.
Why does it bother you? Do you know why it bothers you?
I don't know. Like I think I feel less free to just talk. Like it, I think that's part of it. I'm afraid that I'm going to say something stupid that's going to show up, in a million different places.
Yeah.
But it takes a lot of joy out of it for me, to be honest with you. Like just knowing that's out there. Yeah, I'd rather just have a fun conversation with the people in the room and leave it at
Yeah.
that. If you want to be part of that conversation, you need to be there.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's where you and I are different.
No, I kind of see that too. Like even when I do conferences,
Yeah.
whether if it's being recorded, the panel might depend
Yeah.
on what I say, right? Because I might give a more frank answer if I'm not being
That's
recorded and worrying that that's going to show up on social
so odd. So yeah, that's
media.
such an I genuinely that is the oddest thing I can
Well, and
conceive
because
of.
you know what, though, it can be edited, right? Like out of context. And I think that's the thing
True.
that worries me too. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you start to become mindful of that. Literally everything, every word out of your mouth, you just assume, or at least I assume, is going to end up getting captured and posted somewhere,
Yeah.
without my knowledge, and that curtails what I'm going to say. And frankly, I think it makes it less fun for me and probably less fun for the audience.
Yeah, I could see that then. Yeah. I don't worry about it. I don't worry. I just say what I'm going to say. And I guess
Yeah,
if I'm
we know,
going to be
Kevin.
destroyed
You
for
don't
it,
have a
then I will be
filter.
destroyed. Yeah. I have no filter. But I guess the argument could be made that maybe I should. The two faces of Woodside Motion Company. A company called Woodside Motion has been emailing authors offering to shop their books for film or TV adaptations, but it's often unclear what real connections or success track record they have. Authors who respond may be encouraged to create a quote proof of concept teaser video, which can cost thousands of dollars and is presented as important for getting industry interest. These teaser videos are commonly referred to a separate company, Apex Media Global, which appears to be linked to the same owner as Woodside Motion, raising transparency concerns about the referral process. Overall, the situation highlights a familiar publishing adjacent risk, authors paying significant fees, chasing Hollywood adaptation opportunities that may never materialize. If they ask you for money, they are a scam. That's all Kevin's going to say.
It's probably coming from a Gmail account too, right? Like all these things seem to
Probably.
come from.
They may have a
Oh
legitimate website. And the sad part is sometimes these things are somewhat legitimate. Like they've got some thread of reality to them. But what they're doing is leveraging that they are making money off of those trailers. That's where their money actually comes from. And if they ever do actually land some Hollywood deal, it's because you paid for the video to do it.
But like I've got eight different projects that are working their way through Hollywood. None of them have come together because of something like this.
Yeah.
Like the process is totally different than this. Like you're
Yeah.
not gonna, I mean, and I'm not saying it can't happen, because I do know production companies that they run through NetGalley and stuff like that, looking for things, trying to get ahead of it. But in the traditional world, and unfortunately Hollywood is still very much a traditional world, you need an agent, and that agent is going to put together some type of pitch. And that may include a video reel, it may include a lookbook, which is kind of like a PowerPoint presentation. There's different ways to do it. This goes through an agent. And even if you've
Right.
got other people involved, it doesn't flow this way. They're not going to come to you asking for for money. Now your agent may come to you and say, hey, if we create a reel for this, we might be able to get a little bit more traction. But, you know, that's obviously a real world, you know, scenario. That's not some company reaching to you, you know, out of the blue. Like anybody that just lands in your inbox, you know, like Kevin said, ask you for money, it's bogus.
Yeah. And they did include screenshots of some of these emails. It was from a Gmail account. So you're correct, JD.
Not even willing to commit to the URL.
Nope.
Yeah. All right. Well, next up, What It's Like to Be a Romance Cover Model by Kevin Tomlinson. In 2019, Andrew Flanagan was a welder living in Franklin County, Alabama. Now he's the cover model on dozens of romance novels. It's a transformation that began, as so many things do these days, on TikTok. Flanagan built an audience, now more than 1.7 million, by sharing short videos about his daily life. When he first received a message asking if he'd like to model for a romance novel, he thought it was a scam. Flanagan has since quit welding, sold more than 100 photos directly to authors seeking cover art, and traveled to photo shoots and book events where he's sometimes asked to appear around the country.
So this... Hey, funny story. So for Behind a Closed Door, we had a bunch of influencers that we brought on board to film videos and other promotional stuff. Only one guy actually applied, and this guy had insane abs, and he's got a video where he is basically just leaning up against a wall, his shirt's open so you can see the abs, and there's some guy, I don't even know what the text over it is or whatever. That is the most watched video from all of my ads running on Facebook. The comments on it are insane. Like, you know, just the number of people that review it, like it is just, it stood the test of time. So yeah, abs. This is why I've got a gym at the house.
Abs. There you go, from welder to romance cover model. They had a picture of him at an event with the author. I'm like, what a job. I love it.
That's great. Hey, look, most people brag about their six pack, but I have a keg. So you guys suck it. All right. That is it for the news.
You know that manuscript you've been editing for the past year? One that's almost done, but never quite gets there? Well, right now, it's crying out for help from this episode's sponsor, AutoCrit. Quite possibly the most powerful all-in-one writing platform, AutoCrit puts an entire publishing team in the palm of your hand. Get access to customizable automated alpha and beta readers, plus series-wide story analysis, marketing support, line editing tools that can help you catch the mistakes you miss, and even more, including exclusive craft events only for members. The value is insane, and right now you can grab lifetime access for just one payment. No monthly fees, no usage limits, no caps, no tokens. At AutoCrit, unlimited means unlimited. It's time to finish your book. Start making real progress. Escape revision limbo and publish with confidence story after story. Check out autocrit.com/JD to save 50% on lifetime membership right now. That's autocrit.com/JD.
JD, who's up this week?
This week we've got Steve Barry on. Steve is the New York Times and number one international bestselling author of 20 Cotton Malone novels, 6 standalone thrillers, 2 Luke Daniels adventures, and several works of short fiction. He has over 26 million books in print, translated into 41 languages, and he's here to tell us about his latest book, which is called The Devil's Bible, which just released. So here he is, Steve Barry.
I have had the pleasure of chatting with you a few times, Mr. Steve Barry. Thank you for joining us on the Writers Inc. podcast.
Appreciate you having me.
So you are, you've been going for a while now, and you've written 20 of these Cotton Malone books so far. Mm-hmm. And the newest one is The Devil's Bible, which is an intriguing title. Let's talk a little bit about that. What's the premise behind Devil's Bible?
The Devil's Bible is the largest book in the world. It's real. It exists. It's about 3 feet tall, about 2 foot wide, about 9.5 inches thick, weighs 165 pounds. It was created sometime in the early part of the 13th century. We don't know by who. We know it was somewhere in Bohemia, which is the Czech Republic today. It rattled around Bohemia for about 350-400 years until the Swedes came in 1648, sacked Prague Castle, took it, and it has been in Stockholm ever since. Now, Russia, the United States, the Czech Republic, and Sweden all want this book, but they want it for totally different reasons, each one, and it's up to Cotton Malone to steal it and get it to the right guy.
Well, I won't spoil that.
I can't do that.
I was going to ask who the right guy was, but
can't tell you that. Yeah, can't tell you how that comes out. But it is he does have to steal this book, and then he's got to make some decisions. So it's a good, it's a nice solid thriller.
Now, have you laid eyes on the actual Devil's Bible?
I went to Stockholm, saw it. I got to spend a day. One of the curators of the book spent the day with me and answered a zillion questions. And then I spent the next 7 days going around Sweden, and all of the locations you see in the novel I visited.
Now, there's an interesting picture of the devil in that Bible that if I
very
recall.
Much so. Very
yeah. So you got to lay eyes on that as well.
Only digital images. They do not have the book open.
I see.
But the National Library took high resolution images of every page. I mean, you can focus down to the dust on the page. That's how high res.
Oh, interesting.
Very good images. And this Bible, this devil's image is very unique. You don't see it anywhere else in medieval manuscripts. You don't see it anywhere else because this is before the Renaissance, before the Renaissance painters began to depict the devil. Very fascinating concept, and any listeners who are interested can Google it. Devil's Bible, Devil's Image, take a look at it and you'll see. But that's what gave the book its name.
This one's famous for supposedly having been written in one night, right?
Well, the legend is that a monk was punished. He was walled up in a room, and to save his life, he promised the prior that if I could write a book with all the world's knowledge in it in one night, will you let me go? And the prior said, sure, I'll do that if you do that. Well, he found out he couldn't do it, but the devil appeared. He made a deal with the devil, and the devil got him to do the book, and he also got himself in the book. But that's a story that was created in Sweden after the book got there to give it a little more, you know, mystery and intrigue to it. In reality, though, the reality to me is even more fascinating. There are 310 pages of the book. They are written by one person all the way through. It's the same handwriting.
Yeah.
All the way through. The handwriting on the first page and the handwriting on the last page has not degraded, meaning 30 years passed between those. Now, imagine what your handwriting looked like 30 years ago as opposed to today. But no, it's exactly the same. No degrading of it at all. And there's not one single error anywhere in the book, which is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, that's it's fascinating. This thing keeps coming up, by the way, for me. I was working on a book of my own about this. Now I got to reconsider. Don't want to duplicate what.
You can use it. Just use it in a different way.
Different way. I can't call it the Devil's Bible, though. That's where I'm.
Oh, you can't call the book that. No, that I did kind of take that one away from you. Yeah.
That's all right. We'll come up with something else. So, you said you actually flew in to take a look. Did you specifically go there to look?
Yeah, I went there for the purpose of researching the novel. When I went, I had a general idea of a novel, but I didn't really have a novel. And when I left, I had a novel. So I saw a lot of things there. We were on the one day we were in the old streets, the streets of Old Town of Stockholm, little cobble streets back in the back behind these buildings. It had snowed. We were there in the wintertime, so snow was there. And my guide called me over and she said, come here, I want to show you something. So I went over and she said, see this, that lady there. And there was an elderly lady walking her dog. Just walking her dog by herself, minding her own business. And she said, that's the sister of the King of Sweden. She lives a couple of blocks over. She walks her dog down here every day. We all know she does. No one bothers her. She doesn't like security. She didn't like it. Swedes don't like heavy security anyway. And when I saw that, I got an idea. And that's where really the novel came from, when I saw her walking there, and then the novel began to gel.
Do you have instances like that often when you're researching?
Yeah, actually, I do. It does happen. And that's why you go. You want to be on the ground where you can see things and learn things that are not in books, that are not written down anywhere. And that's another example of just being in the right place at the right time.
Yeah. Is this a typical thing for you to board a plane, go do the research for a book?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we do at least one trip every novel. And I don't go just to go. I go because I can't find what I'm looking for in books. And in this case, there's almost nothing written on the Devil's Bible. There are no books on it. There are no nothing. So I had to go to the source. And luckily, the curator there took pity on me and gave me a wonderful book on the Devil's Bible that I was able in English that I was able to read, which really helped a lot.
Yeah. Is that so? It's just fascinating to me. I mean, I've done some travel in the name of research, but I don't think I've ever just boarded a plane and gone to take a look at, you know, some ancient manuscript.
I don't go haphazardly though. Now I spent 3 months getting ready for that trip, reading, studying, looking at things, seeing what I might want to go see, what I might not want to see, these kinds of things. I do a lot of preliminary work. I don't go on the ground just, oh, here I am, let me see what I can find. It doesn't work like that. I have a plan. It modifies as we get on the ground. And I had a wonderful guide there. She was lovely. And she's a character in the novel. I named the Prime Minister of Sweden after her. And Simone took us everywhere. And she got really into it. And she was very, very helpful.
Yeah. Now, you've mixed in some current events to this. What was the challenge there?
Well, I weave the story around Sweden's admission into NATO, which for a long time was held up by Turkey. Turkey voted no. To get into NATO, you have to have all the members unanimous vote. And Turkey had been voting no for a long, long time. I took that, and in my novel, it's not Turkey, it's the Czech Republic. Okay. And I wove it around that, what's going on. That's what I do in all of my books. I take something from the past, something real, something you may not know a lot about, but I'm hoping you want to know more about. And I weave a modern day thriller around that. And in this case, that's it worked out well. Now, while I was writing the book, Turkey finally voted yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did that throw anything?
No, because I'm using Czech Republic.
It's a fictional,
I'm using Czech Republic. But in the writer's note in the back, I explained all that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I find myself using real world events in some of my stuff and current events in some of my books, but it kind of turns around to bite me in the butt sometimes.
You don't want to be too current. You can't be too current.
How do you find that balance?
I'm careful there. I do not go too current, and I don't go too specific.
Yeah,
I'm very careful about that because you will. Yes, you will. You will lose. You could date your book, or you could outdate your book.
Right.
Careful. So I'm very careful about that. I don't go in too specific.
Yeah, I had an incident recently where something I wrote about in fiction ended up actually happening in the real world. Have you had that happen?
I've had that happen. Yes.
What do you do when? I mean,
you just go.
Yeah.
I wrote The Third Secret in 2005, and my Pope died, and my new Pope was German.
Yeah.
The book came out in June, and John Paul died in April, May. And they elected the Pope in early June of 05. And I had already put a German Pope in there, which is.
Yeah.
So it happens. I've had other instances where that happens, too. You go with it. That actually worked out great because it's almost like I had a crystal ball.
Yeah. Well, now, have you ever written something that, you know, maybe it happened, maybe it came along or something similar came along and you felt maybe a little alarmed about leaving it in the book? Have you ever had to yank something?
I haven't had to yank anything. No, I haven't had to do that. I'm vague enough that I'm okay. I've had to tweak a little here and there, but I don't go that I consciously, because you have to understand I'm writing a book.
Yeah.
Like right now I'm writing a book that's going to be read 2 years from now.
Right.
So not only do I have to be careful, I gotta be careful for what's going to happen 2 years from now.
Right.
I have to be careful about all of that. So I don't go too specific. And here it worked out great because I just changed the country.
Right. Now, do you work with developmental editors for these books?
No.
Okay.
I do all that myself. Everything.
Yeah. Everything. Is there a hang up there? What makes you decide?
I come up with my, I didn't know there's something called a developmental editor, really?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't even know there was such a thing.
We won't go into it, but yeah.
Wow. They actually help you develop a plot then, huh?
Well, they kind of help with, there's a lot of things that they'll do to kind of help shape the book, but we don't have to go into it.
Oh, I know. I didn't know there was such a thing. Yeah. No, I do I do all that myself, everything.
Yeah, sometimes you'll work with one and they'll catch something like, hey, you talked about this event, this geopolitical event, and there's this going on that might alarm people or whatever. So, yeah,
it's never a bad thing to have different eyes on something.
That's true. Now, you actually kind of deal with some themes of cultural ownership when it comes to the Bible, the Devil's Bible. That's a big topic. That's a hot topic, actually.
It is.
You know,
it
with is. Museums kind of claiming ownership of things and, does it belong to the museum? Does it belong to the culture? How are you handling that in the book?
Well, the Czech Republic wants the Devil's Bible back. I mean, they've wanted it back for decades, and they pushed hard. Swedes aren't going to give it back.
Yeah.
I dealt with that in the book. It is dealt with in there. But in the book, that's one reason. Remember, I said the Czech Republic's one of the ones who want it. They want it
right.
because it belongs to them, and they want it back. I deal with that. That's dealt with very heavily in the novel. Absolutely. But at the time, in 1648, the law was the winner of the war can plunder whatever they want to plunder.
Yeah.
That was the way it was in 1648. And the Swedes consider the Devil's Bible theirs. It's actually, its proper name is the Codex Gigas.
Yeah.
This giant book.
Giant book,
giant
right.
book. And, yeah. and they consider that book theirs, and they're not giving it back. They loaned it to the Czechs a few years ago for a year or so. And the Czechs have a facsimile of the book.
Yeah.
That they display in Prague. And Dan Brown actually used that facsimile in his new book, The Secret of Secrets.
Yep, yeah. sure did. Yeah. That's what I'm saying, man. This thing is popping up all over the place. Man.
Yeah, I deal with that a lot of things. A lot of my books have dealt with treasure stolen that people want back.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's a handy MacGuffin, you know? Mm-hmm. Do you deal with supernatural themes at all in these books?
No. Yeah. We call that woo-woo.
Yeah.
No woo-woo in my genre. No.
It's just right there, though. It's the Devil's Bible. There's all this mythology.
It's got the legends and all that, and I do deal with that, but I don't ever have any, no woo-woo in my books.
Yeah. You don't even toe the line? You don't that maybe there's something?
My readers would have little to no patience with that. Now, there are people who do it. Like the Pendergast books are marvelous. Where Doug Preston and Lincoln Child just take that right to the edge, and pull it back, and they're really really good at it. They've written some. I mean, the Cabinet of Curiosities, all of the books that they've written with him are just wonderful. But that's not my niche.
Yeah, how do you find the balance between like the research, the fact driven stuff, and the stuff that you're just going to make up? I mean, what? You don't, if you're staying away from woo, I figure you're probably trying to stay away from making too many facts up.
Well, so. Right, because I keep my books about 90% to reality, 90% to history. I change that history up about 10% because I'm here to entertain you. And that's why I put the writer's note in the back that tells you where I did that so that you have no misconceptions. But I keep my books, that's the niche I've carved for myself, is I keep them as close as I can to reality. And this book stays really, really close.
Yeah.
I just changed Turkey and Czech Republic. I there's very little. I kept it really, really tight and really, really close.
Now you bring back a character in this one.
I do.
A love interest for Cotton Malone. Tell us about her.
Well, Cassiopeia comes back with him here. They're together and they are, I broke them up in one book in the Lincoln myth. That was because I never intended for Cotton to be monogamous. I actually wanted him to move around and experience a few things. It would be more fun for me as a writer to do all that. But my wife, Elizabeth, would not allow that because Cassiopeia is basically her. And she said, you're not doing that. So they are together and they form a team and they do a great job here. And I brought back another character from the Emperor's Tomb. Who makes an appearance in this book as well. This book is a long, I started this journey in Atlas Maneuver 2 years ago. Cotton's world is getting upended. I'm upending his world a bit and things are changing in his world. This Atlas Maneuver had a change where he may or may not have a daughter.
Mm.
Medici Return took it along. Then this book has a change in his world, and there'll be another change coming in 2028 There's a lot happening in Cotton's world. I want to kind of reboot things a little bit. It'll be fun for me. I hope fun for the readers. We'll get some new challenges for him. There'll still be a lot the same, but there'll also be some different things.
Yeah. Did you get like letters of complaint or anything when you broke them up?
No. Oh, when I broke them up? No, I did not. But people were okay with it. Only Elizabeth. She said, absolutely not. That's not going to happen. People like them. I did get a lot of letters over the years about them being together. They like them together. So now they're a team and they work as a team. She's in this book. She will not be in 28. She'll come back in 30.
Yeah. So you plan pretty far out. I remember from past conversations, but not specifically. So you are very much an outliner, right?
Well, I'm a little more of a pantser than I used to be. I used to be a strict outliner, but now I do a little more pantsing. I don't know why. I guess because I know how to outline in my head now.
Uh-huh.
I can kind of outline in my head. And I kind of stay 50 pages ahead, maybe 100 pages ahead. But I do a little more pantsing now than I do.
Interesting. Interesting. So how are you? How far out do you have this series planned?
Oh God, I hope it goes forever.
Well, yes, granted. And I want that too as a reader.
I have 28, 30. I'm transitioning to a book every 2 years.
Okay.
So there'll be a Cotton book, not be a Cotton book next year. There'll be one in 28. Then there'll be one in 30 and 32. I'm going to do a book every 2 years starting now. And so there'll be a book in 27, but it'll be a Luke Daniels book.
I see.
Coming. So I'm transitioning. I've been doing this now 36 years. So my brain's a little tired. So I'm going to go to a book every 2 years and it'll reduce the workload dramatically for me. So I've got 28, 30 and 32 done where I want.
Is that you're going to do a Cotton book every 2 years or just a book?
No, a Cotton book every 2 years. Cotton book every 2 years.
Yeah.
And probably in between those books, there'll be some novellas.
I'm seeing a lot of that. I'm seeing a lot of authors kind of lean in that direction.
I like novellas. We can do them quickly. We can move them along fast. We can have a lot of fun with them. They're a little more fun to deal with. Novellas are.
What do you see as the primary difference between writing a novella and writing a full novel?
It's much harder to write a novella because shorter is always harder.
Yeah.
It's much more difficult. It's got to be so compact and so tight.
Yeah.
Novel that I just, the Devil's Bible is my shortest novel I've ever written at 90,000 words. And it was hard. It's very hard to write short. But I wanted to write shorter. I wanted to see if I could do it. And I did it. And so I'm going to stay in that range now of that. But I've kind of learned the skills of how to do it. Novellas are even shorter. You're talking about 40,000 words. So it's even.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. But they have to be, everything has to be chosen carefully. And I'm sure we'll do a series of novellas that'll make up through that time period.
Yeah. I think the last time I talked to you, you said something about how you really enjoy, like, you're always looking for the learning experience, like the next thing you can learn in this business. Is that
very much so?
Yeah.
Every book I do one thing I've never done before, craft wise, something to challenge me. I've never done it. Then this one was short. How short can I get this book? How tight can I get this book? And I'll tell you, it was tough. It's tough.
Yeah. Have you, what about short stories? Have you?
I'm very, they're hard for me. They're really hard for me to write short stories. That's even harder when you're talking about 10, 15,000 words or less.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've written 4 or 5, but they're a challenge.
Yeah, I think that's going to come as a surprise to a lot of writers because
there's nothing easy about writing a short story.
No, that's true. That's true. Do you see the same sort of, the same sort of aura of success when you put out a novella versus a novel?
Yeah, they sell really well. They don't sell at the level of a full length novel, no. But over time, they do really, really well. The great thing is they can be written quickly. I usually do those with co-writers. They write the first draft and then I take it and rewrite it.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I come up with a story idea. I give them the idea of what I want, but I say, you're not married to that. You got a better idea. I'm cool with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then they write the first draft because I've got to put it in my voice.
Yeah.
It's got to be in my voice, and I can't teach them my voice. It takes forever. It's just easier. Write it. Let me rewrite it. And that's so it becomes a true collaborative effort.
Yeah. I just did a video talking about voice. How do you determine your voice?
Well, it comes from time as you write, you begin to know what appeals to you. How do you phrase your sentences? How do you put your diction and syntax, your choice of words and the order of words? Mm-hmm. Every one of us have a different way of doing it. I mean, there's a lot of times I can read something blind. I can tell you who wrote it, particularly of major thriller writers. I can tell because I know their voice. I know how they put things together. I study voice very carefully, and we all have to develop our own voice. But as a co-writing situation, it's got to be in my voice because my readers are buying it. And it's impossible. That's a big ask to ask someone, you need to write like me now. That's hard. That's a hard ask. You know?
Yeah.
So I just tell them, give it your best shot. Do it. I'll fix it.
Have you encountered anybody who comes pretty close to your voice?
Not yet.
Are you hopeful for it? Or are you?
It would be lovely because I don't want to rewrite the stories. I'd much rather edit the stories. But that's really a hard ask of people to ask because they'd have to read a lot of my stuff and study it very carefully, and I don't expect them to do that.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that you use co-authors on the shorter books. That's kind of the opposite of what most people end up doing.
Yeah, I would have a really tough time on a longer book. We'd have it'd be easier just for me to write it.
I do understand that.
Yeah, I would just write if it on a novel. I don't think I would do that. No, I would just much more simpler for me just to write the novel.
Yeah. So you've planned ahead two or 3 years, at least 3 years that I remember.
I know 6 years.
6 years. Okay. So what if you're not plotting them out? How are you keeping track or developing the?
Well, I do plot them out. I write down my notes and all, but I don't do a detailed outline like I was used to do. No, but I do write down all of my notes and thought processes. And then before I start writing a word, I plot the first 100 pages.
Okay.
Yeah. So I know what I want to do. Then as I'm writing the 100 pages, I plot the next 200. Then I stay like 100 ahead, and that's how I do it. It works for me now. I've done this now. I've written 29 books. So I've kind of got the hang of it now. So I know how to do it. And I don't have to do it the long, hard way anymore. But new writers have to do it the long, hard way for a while. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. Yeah, I've tried outlining. I've done it successfully a couple of times. And, you know, there's definitely something to be said for it. But I've now gone back to pantsing.
Pantsing.
Yeah.
You have to do what's comfortable for you.
Let me ask you about the mechanics of your outlining then. Like, because everybody seems to do it different. What's your method? How do you
actually do it? It's a very sophisticated system I use, highly sophisticated. I take one piece of paper. I write chapter one at the top. I write the point of view character next. I write where the scene's going to be set. And then I put notes down of what I want in that scene. Then the next paper's chapter two, chapter three, chapter four. Sometimes I do that in a computer on a Word file, in a Word file, but that's the simplest way to do it. And then as I go through, I can go back and change and adapt and say, no, wait a minute, I need to foreshadow that in chapter two. Let me go back and put that in there. And that's how I do it. Very simple, simple, simple. Keep it simple. Don't get complicated with it.
I can't seem to do that. I end up writing the book as an outline, and then I just sort of...
Well, something to be said, but that's what Jeffrey Deaver does. He writes a 200-page outline and then goes back and puts flesh on it and makes a novel out of it.
Well, there you go. Maybe I'm doing it right after all.
Yeah.
So before we wrap up, I mean, I know you got 6 years of books coming and all that, but what's in the sort of immediate future now following this one?
Well, this one, the next book will be next year. It'll be the third Luke Daniels book that I did with Grant Blackwood.
Okay.
We did these together and I did a book. I did a full length book with Grant and doing it. And if anybody came as close to mimicking my style, he would have been the one.
Yeah.
But Grant was a professional, you know, he'd written with Clancy. Jim Robbins, right. and Cussler. So
yeah.
he knew he's a pro.
Yeah.
We're doing the third Luke Daniels book next year. It's called The Sorcerer's Veil. It's a lot of fun because Walt Disney is a big character in the novel. He's a the plot involves Disney. I've been wanting to do this for a long time, and I finally found a plot that works. So Luke Daniels is going to get hooked up with that, and that'll be the third adventure, and then Cotton will be back in 28.
Excellent. All right. Where can people find out more about you and the books and everything else?
Everything's on my website, steveberry.org. Everything's there. They can check all 27 books. They're all there.
27 and counting. Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks, Steve.
So now Steve talked about he likes to visit the physical locations to find the story. But I immediately think about writers who just don't have the means to do that. So what do you think, how important is it for you to have that hands-on experience with a location to write about it?
I always wanted to be that guy, you know, who just gets on the airplane with a notepad just filled with stuff that I want to research, you know, and head off to wherever. But it doesn't play out for me. Like typically when I'm writing a scene, I'll jump on Google, I'll use Google Earth or whatever to get a visual. You know, there's plenty of pictures of buildings, you know, floor plans, everything that you need is right there at your fingertips. So I don't see the practical need to do this. I mean, I can tell you like Dan Brown, though, he loves this. Like he lives for this. This is his favorite part of the process. He'll plant himself in some location with his notepad out. He'll sketch everything out, take a ton of notes, and that stuff will make it into the book, you know. So it just depends on you as an author. You know, I tend to write fast too. You know, I'll put out 3 or 4 books a year. You know, some of these guys are maybe 1 book a year. In Dan's case, I think it was 7 years between the last one. You know, if you're visiting every location, it's obviously going to be a little bit of a time suck, so you got to factor that in too.
I think it's genre dependent too, right? Steve writes historical events close to the real world. Probably his readers demand more factually accurate books. But yeah, I don't do it either. Like if I happen to be traveling somewhere and that inspires a book, that's that's cool. But I also don't spend 3 months researching the location before I write.
I mean, I travel a lot. I go to a lot of locations and a lot of those end up showing up in my books. But And, you know, Kara and I are weird. I mean, we're nomadic, so maybe it all kind of washes out the same. But I don't go somewhere specifically to say, hey, I'm going to research a book for, you know, in this place. I kind of just collect things as I go, like one big giant rolling gumball, you know. I happen to be in Wyoming, and there's a cool story in Wyoming. That's probably going to go in a future book. But,
yeah. I mean, I'd love to do what he's doing. I wouldn't be opposed
Me
to
neither.
It. I had an idea. And the money and the opportunity, that'd be kind of fun. But
Well, I mean, there's something there. I mean, like to actually stand in the room with the devil's Bible is obviously going to give you a very different vibe than you would get, you know, pulling up pictures and images and stuff of it. It's almost like, you know, a concert. You know, you can watch a concert on TV, you know, all day long, but you're not going to get that feeling that you get when that person takes stage in front of you 100 feet away or you know, depending on your tickets.
But I think that, what's important for the author who wants to be able to do things like this and maybe can't afford to or doesn't have the opportunity is there's an idea that's similar to like transferable skills. Like if you experience something, so if you would love to write about the devil's Bible, but you don't have access to it, there's probably something somewhere within driving range of you that would give you the same sort of feeling. Like being in the room with, you know, go to a museum and stand in, you know, next to an exhibit or whatever, or go to, you know, in this case, maybe some archival library or something, you know, you can go and experience that and transfer what you feel from that to what you, you know about that thing from what you study online. I don't know if any of that's making sense, but that's...
No, I mean, I kind of approach that. Like when we go on a trip somewhere, a lot of times I'll just break out my phone and just, you know, key in like odd locations near me, odd tourist traps near me.
Yeah.
You know, like where you are right now, Kevin, I could tell you that there is a street that like literally everybody picked up and left on the same day, like back in the 50s. Like the houses were completely abandoned, food still on the kitchen tables. Nobody's wow. knows why they actually left. And you can like walk through those houses. I mean, they're falling apart and it's dangerous.
I've seen that on social media.
there's also a street that's basically on fire underneath. Underground because of the coal mines not very far from you. So like those kind of things, you know, like you're never going to get that from Google. But if you're nearby, you can see them, and those things exist everywhere. I mean, you could go to Kansas, you can go to California. It doesn't matter. You're going to find something cool to look at like that.
Yeah, even just I remember Ray Bradbury did the transfer thing. You know, when he's trying to remember what it felt like to be a kid, went back to his childhood neighborhood and just walked through it in the backyard to kind of get those memories and those feelings. So even if it's not something, you know, unusual or super cool, even those kind of things can really give you those transferable skills too.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a big part of that concept of write what you know. It's not about like direct experience all the time. It's you're writing about the experience you have as a person, you know, that's what you want to relate. So Steve was saying that he tries to keep his books around 90% real and 10% changed. So how do you decide which 10% to sort of bend, and what happens if that 10% becomes the part that everyone remembers?
I mean, I've tried to, you know, include as many real facts as possible in a lot of the books, and that makes it fun, you know, not only when you're writing it, but as a reader, I think, to stumble into that, you know, to be able to look it up and realize, oh, this is actually a real thing. But yeah, you can only control so much of it. I mean, like what he mentioned about the Pope, you know, like those kind of events just sort of playing out, and then tying into the book, you know, life happens too. You know, war may break out. You've got a book you're writing, it's, you know, set in the Ukraine, and all of a sudden we're at war with Ukraine.
Right.
You know, your book is 90% done. Like, are you even able to finish that book now? So in a lot of ways, it's best to steer clear of real world events just because they can actually impact the book itself. So you got to walk that tightrope.
Yeah. Like Steve said, not too current. Way past, so like not much is going to change, not too specific. And then, yeah, hopefully you don't get in trouble. But yeah, things change, you can't foresee, right? We don't have crystal balls. So I don't know what you do. I don't know. You rework it, you revise.
Revise.
Yeah.
Yeah. I get, I get emails all the time from people who compliment me on some piece of research I did for, you know, I never knew about X, you know, among the Mayans or whatever. And it turns out, you know, that was the thing I made up. But then it turned out that it was
true.
Some, you know, somehow historically accurate. So I think we absorb a lot of things.
Well, yeah, you probably picked up on it at some point, and subconsciously it was back in the attic somewhere and your brain just pulled it out.
Had to, either that or I am highly psychic. he talked about how he likes, I do this too. Like, he challenges himself to do some new craft experiment with each book. You know, what do you think is a meaningful way for new writers to do that without derailing the story, to try new craft things or to challenge yourself in some way?
For new writers?
Or any writer, really, I guess.
Said for new writers, I don't know you want to do that yet, but...
I mean, I think it's important to change it up. It keeps it fun, keeps it interesting. You know, if you do the same thing over and over again, you know, even if it's something like writing and you love to write, you're going to get bored with it. You know, we've talked about this before. So I've got a book I'm writing on a typewriter. I've got one I'm writing out longhand. I've got, you know, I typically work in Scrivener, you know, but I'll change that up. And I know you're writing something out right now longhand, right, Kevin? So like, you know, I find that my voice is different if I change just the medium a little bit.
Actually, I just started dictating the book I'm working on because I was struggling. I've never dictated. I don't know. Kevin must be getting in my brain. but I was struggling with the voice on it. And so the dictating actually helped with that because it's just more natural. Like, you're telling a story to somebody. Right?
That's that brain to brain interface thing you were talking about, by the way.
Stop
That's what's happening.
Brain interfacing. Through the internet.
I think it's important to sort of try new ways of doing this. You know, I was kind of exploring this in one of my videos recently, but, and it just sort of hit me that this was a good method, but like, I always struggle with things like outline or whatever. Well, should I be doing this? Should I write by hand? Should I dictate? I think you should maybe try, especially if you switch genres, but the different things that you write, try a different approach each time just to see if that's going to change things up, give you a different voice. Especially if, because like I fell into a rut for a long while, you know, especially with the Kotler books, like there's only so many ways to, explore an underground. You know, I had a lot of underground caves, a lot of, you know, lost artifacts. There's only so many stories to tell with that scenario. But if you changed up how you're telling it, like the actual literal method you're using to tell it, you know, you'll end up kind of discovering new things and new ways to explore the topic.
Yeah.
But maybe that's just seasoned writers who should do that. Maybe new writers stick to one thing for a while.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Well, that's it.
Cool. JD, who's up next week?
Next week, we've got Lee Kelly and Jennifer Thorne coming on. They're a writing team behind the book The Midnight Show. It's an immersive page-turner about surviving as a funny woman in the male-dominated world of comedy, which releases April 7th. So two of them, Lee Kelly and Jennifer Thorne.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.